This ruling is not going to change the fact that Trump's allies have a plan that, if all else fails, to eliminate medication abortion through executive action.
They sure do have a lot of plans, don't they? Do we?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast-to-coast and around the globe every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around infected fellow from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today, okay? I probably should not be here at all today, since, as you may have heard or read, as I explained at bradblog.com yesterday, I tested positive yet again for COVID on Tuesday night, right after we got off the air.
Yay, more COVID adventures.
Yes. Now, normally I might call my friend Nicole Sandler to fill in for us today since I'm sick, but as luck would have it, in an entirely different state, I'm in California, she's in Arizona, on the very same day, our friend Nicole also tested positive for COVID. In her case, for the very first time after 5 years or so of having avoided it. So get well soon, Nicole.
Yes.
So out of options here, and with so much going on today and this week, and the fact that my symptoms are largely fairly mild overall, and the fact that Desi Doyen just had COVID a week or two ago, so
yeah,
you should be largely immune at this point, right?
Exactly.
Now that you've given it to me again.
Well, we don't know where you got it from,
sure,
but it is important for folks to know that there is
sure
a surge going on
right
around the country,
yeah,
so take precautions.
It could have come from anywhere, right? Anyway, with all of that in mind and hopped up on whatever symptom-relieving medication I can get my hands on, I'm going to try to get through the hour of today's show. Please bear with me with any coughs and sneezing or gravelly, congested voice you may hear along the way. My apologies. So let's jump right in. Since we were off yesterday due to my illness, I didn't get to follow up on Tuesday's down-ballot primary elections in Maine, Nevada, North Dakota, South Carolina, and in Ohio, which held a special election for the U.S. House on Tuesday. Happily, there were not too many problems of note for voters, or in the tabulations, at least so far, that I've been able to learn about. And since we've got both a guest coming up today shortly and a big ruling on Thursday coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court that we need to cover, I've got time to only tell you for the moment that there were no big surprises in the results on Tuesday in the primaries in those states. But there was something of note that I want to mention in at least one of them. That's, I think, worth sticking a pin in as we move toward this year's general elections on November 5, which, by the way, are now less than 150 days away. Just FYI. Anyway, there was a special election for the U.S. House in Ohio's 6th congressional district on Tuesday between Republican Michael Rooley and Democrat Michael Kripchak to fill the vacant seat of Republican Congressman Bill Johnson, who resigned in January to become president of Youngstown State University. Johnson won his last four elections for Congress, most recently in 2022 in the 6th District, which is one of Ohio's most Republican-leaning districts. He won his last four elections by more than 30 points. Donald Trump also carried that district by about 30 points back in 2020. So depending on who you turn to here, the district is believed to be anywhere from a plus 16 for Republicans, according to the Cook Political Report, to as much as 29% in favor of Republicans by other political analysts. Well, on Tuesday, in fact, the Republican Michael Rooley did, in fact, win in that special election over the Democrat Michael Kripchak, but by much less than those numbers might suggest he would have. Rooley reportedly won by just over 9 points, 9.3 specifically, which is approximately a 20-point swing in favor of Democrats from the last U.S. House election in that district.
That's a pretty big swing.
A 20-point swing toward the Democrat. Now, we've seen quite a bit of that sort of thing since 2020, Democrats outperforming expectations, even in very red districts. And I don't note that to suggest that Joe Biden is somehow going to win Ohio this year, though he certainly could. But I mention it by way of saying, take nothing for granted this year. Do not be either swayed or discouraged by polling numbers or pundits in either direction, including the fact that, you know, over the past several days, there have been about four different new polls by major pollsters showing Joe Biden now tied with or ahead of Donald Trump nationally. Since the former president's 34 criminal felony convictions in New York. Ignore those, essentially. Take nothing for granted and do not be swayed or discouraged by polling and pundit predictions that you either like or don't like. You know, in the end, as we have seen, what happens on election day may be very different from what we might expect before election day. We saw signs of that yet again on Tuesday in Ohio, of all places. So, next week, there are elections in Georgia, Oklahoma, and Virginia, and I'm hoping that voters get out in those states and pleasantly surprise us as well. And meanwhile, the big news on Thursday this week, of course, comes from our stolen, packed, and wildly corrupted far-right U.S. Supreme Court, which defied expectations somewhat by doing mostly the right thing for now. Don't expect that to remain the case over the next several weeks when rulings in a number of other very big cases will be coming down before the court takes its annual 3-month holiday at the beginning of July. The Supreme Court on Thursday unanimously preserved access to a medication that was used in nearly 2/3 of all abortions in the U.S. last year in the court's first abortion decision since its corrupted far-right justices overturned Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. The court, for now, maintained access to mifepristone, the widely available abortion pill, rejecting a bid from a group of anti-abortion organizations and doctors to unravel the FDA's approval of the pill. In the unanimous decision, written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, the court held that the plaintiffs who sued in a very specific U.S. district court in Texas lacked standing to challenge the FDA's actions. Kavanaugh wrote that the groups could instead seek greater regulatory or legislative restrictions on the drug and noted that doctors who oppose abortion were already shielded by so-called conscience protections in federal law, which means they're not required to provide treatment that would, quote, violate the doctor's religious beliefs or moral convictions. They don't believe in abortion. They don't believe in the use of these pills. Good. They can't be forced to prescribe them to someone. That's already been the federal law. The challenge before the court centered on changes that the FDA put in place in 2016 and 2021, broadening the distribution of the pill by easing patients' ability to receive it through telemedicine and by mail. But the decision does not rule out the possibility that other plaintiffs who might have standing, notably states, well, they may be able to pursue challenges to the availability of mifepristone, which is now used in a majority of abortions in the country. So the doctors can't do it, but maybe other people, other states in this case could. Abortion is now banned at all stages of pregnancy in 14 states, and after about 6 weeks of pregnancy in others, three others, often before women even realize they're pregnant.
Yeah, that would be an effective ban.
Access to the abortion drug mifepristone prescribed via telemedicine from out-of-state doctors has been a lifeline. Many of these women seeking care in those states since the court overturned Roe in 2022. Abortion rights activists were pleased by the Thursday decision, but they cautioned that it merely maintained the current status quo. Yeah, don't get too giddy. It just allows us to keep the rights that we have already earned, including in the 14 states with near total abortion bans. Even as they celebrated, abortion rights supporters warned of the risks ahead. Nancy Northup, the president of the Center for Reproductive Rights, said in a statement, quote, the anti-abortion movement sees how critical abortion pills are in this post-Roe world, and they are hell-bent on cutting off access. Quote, we are far from out of the woods, warned Cecile Richards, the former president of Planned Parenthood. In fact, this case itself may not actually be over. Three Republican states, Missouri, Idaho, and Kansas, were actually able to intervene as plaintiffs at the lower court level in this case, and they might try to revive it down there. Erin Hawley, the wife of Missouri's far-right U.S. Senator Josh Hawley, she's also a lawyer. She's a lawyer for Alliance Defending Freedom, which argued to restrict the pill. She stressed that the court ruled only on the standing of her clients. Quote, they didn't get to the merits of the case. She said those merits will hopefully be at issue later on as the states move forward. So clearly the states do plan to move forward. Clearly they feel that their argument, the merits that they're putting forward, such as they have any, will be explored in a further case that they clearly plan to bring. We still have work to do, she said, adding, quote, ADF is encouraged and hopeful that the FDA will be held to account. Account for what? Doing good work in approval of very safe and popular drugs, being the gold standard for that sort of thing across the planet? The groups who challenged the use of the drug cited two studies in their case that were actually later retracted, that questioned the safety of mifepristone, which was approved by the FDA more than two decades ago. Their claim contradicted a huge scientific record on the safety of mifepristone, which has been repeatedly found to be safer than either Tylenol or Viagra. The FDA's approval process, as I note, is widely regarded as the gold standard in medicine internationally. Both the Biden administration and drug manufacturers had warned that siding with abortion opponents in this case could actually undermine the FDA's drug approval process in other cases beyond the abortion context by inviting judges who are not medical doctors, to essentially second-guess the agency's scientific judgments. The Democratic administration and New York-based Danco Laboratories, which makes mifepristone, argued that the drug is among the safest that the FDA has ever approved. Julie Chavez Rodriguez, President Biden's campaign manager, noted that the challenge to the abortion pills happened because of the decision to overturn Roe, which removed federal protections for abortions, and that the court overturned Roe v. Wade only because former President Donald J. Trump appointed three right-wing justices to the court. Yes, packed the court. She and Mini Timuraju, the president of Reproductive Freedom for All, noted that Project 2025, drafted by groups supporting Trump, included a plan for him to direct the Food and Drug Administration to simply remove its approval of these abortion pills. Trump allies are also pushing the revival of the Comstock Act. If you haven't heard of that, get yourself familiar with it. It's a 19th century anti-vice law to prohibit the mailing of pills, even in states that allow abortion. This challenge to Mifepristone originated in Texas, where an umbrella group of anti-abortion medical organizations set up shop, along with several doctors, to specifically challenge the FDA's longstanding approval of Mifepristone. They will stop at nothing. In the fall of 2022, they filed a lawsuit in Amarillo, Texas, in the panhandle of the Lone Star State, where a single federal judge, the far-right Matthew Kaczmarek, a Donald Trump appointee, hears all new civil cases. They filed it there on purpose. They filed the case there for exactly that reason, knowing that they were likely to get a favorable ruling from this guy who, in fact, did go ahead and issue a nationwide ban on the drug until that was temporarily turned back and now, for the moment anyway, overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. In the end, Justice Kavanaugh wrote for the majority in Thursday's 9-0 opinion, the anti-abortion doctors went to the wrong forum and they should instead direct their energies to persuading lawmakers and/or regulators to make changes. Those comments pointed to the stakes of the 2024 election and the possibility that an FDA commissioner appointed by Republican Donald Trump, if he wins the White House, could simply tighten access to Mifepristone or ban its use entirely. Yes, even in the states where abortion is still allowed in this country. Vice President Kamala Harris offered a statement following Thursday's ruling toward that end.
I just want to quickly address the Supreme Court's ruling today on medication abortion. This is not a cause for celebration, because the reality is certain things are still not going to change. We are looking at the fact that two-thirds of women of reproductive age in America live in a state with a Trump abortion ban. This ruling is not going to change that. This ruling is not going to change the fact that Trump's allies have a plan that, if all else fails, to eliminate medication abortion through executive action. So we must remain clear-eyed about the threats to reproductive freedom in America, and we must remain vigilant.
Sadly, this challenge to personal rights and freedoms by the Republican Party, which pretends to support personal rights and freedoms, this attempt by far-right Republicans to insert the government between patients and their doctors, as Republicans had previously pretended to oppose, specifically in their opposition to Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as you may recall. This will continue, whether carried out by states like Missouri, Idaho, or Kansas, in this specific challenge to popular abortion pills, or through other inventive means manufactured by many of the same right, far-right groups who concocted the challenge, the now failed challenge for the moment to the use of Mifepristone nationwide. And they will do it again, yet again, through the very same well-funded legal mill and forum shopping network, hoping to end up in courts like Matthew Kaczmarek's. And as we'll discuss with our guest momentarily, not just courts like Kaczmarek's, but Kaczmarek's actual court, where in Texas, right now, two university professors are now trying to punish their own female students who choose to go out of state to obtain an abortion. That story and more is straight ahead with Amanda Marcotte of Salon, and Desi Doyen's latest Green News report is also ahead today.
Yes, it is.
Right here on the broadcast, I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, the nation, for now anyway, appears to have dodged a bullet on Thursday at the stolen, packed, and corrupted right-wing U.S. Supreme Court with a unanimous 9-0 decision by the court to dismiss a challenge to the use of the mifepristone drug, a very safe, as determined over more than 20 years by the FDA, and very popular medical abortion method used in about two-thirds of the abortion cases in the U.S. at this point. That challenge, however, was turned away from the court only on the basis that the doctors filing the challenge did not have standing to sue, since they are not required to prescribe the drug and they have no record of treating women with complications in having used it. But the case made it to the high court thanks to a case that was filed in North Texas and heard by a strident, far-right, Christian nationalist, abortion-opposing judge appointed by Donald Trump, a U.S. District Court judge named Matthew Kaczmarek, who banned the use of mifepristone nationwide after hearing the case and before his ruling was paused and then turned away altogether today by the nation's top court. As noted, a bullet dodged, if only for the moment, as there are more bullets absolutely certain to come in this fight by the far right to take away still more rights from Americans based on their supposed far-right Christian nationalist views that they seem to believe trump everyone else's rights. As we discussed with Austin, Texas-based journalist and activist Andrea Grimes a week or so ago on this program, the recently adopted Texas State Republican Party platform may sound insane, but it should not be taken that way because Grimes, who's been covering Lone Star State GOP convention since 2010, warned that while the platforms adopted by the state party in recent years may sound as if they are only meant to appease the party's farthest right fringe elements, those platform planks actually have, in the ensuing years after passage, gone from seemingly crackpot ideas at the state GOP party convention into state law. Adopted by the state's Republican-dominated legislature and signed by its far-right Republican governor, Greg Abbott, before subsequently being repeated and adopted by other GOP-controlled states as well. As I noted at the time that we spoke with Grimes, what happens in Texas decidedly does not stay in Texas, unfortunately. As she wrote in a column at MSNBC late last month, there are many, many horrors to behold in the state GOP's latest platform, and they must be taken seriously, not in spite of how terrifying the document is, but because of how terrifying the document is. As she noted, it is because the latest Texas GOP platform endorses, quote, prohibiting the teaching of sex education, sexual health, or sexual choice or identity, unquote, that we should take it seriously. It is because the platform equates abortion with murder that we should take it seriously. It is because the platform aims to ban any Democrat, and indeed any non-compliant Republican, from ever holding statewide office again, that we should take it seriously. As if to underscore Andrea Grimes' point, Amanda Marcotte at Salon recently reported there that a pair of Texas professors figured out that their female students have sex. And boy, they do not like it. So now, as Marcotte explains, the philosophy professor and finance professor at the University of Austin are actually suing for the right to punish their students who, outside of class, have abortions. Yes, I know it sounds insane, but it is because it sounds insane at this point in 2024 in the great state of Texas that we should regard it as, well, probably not insane at all, at least as Texas Republicans see it. And in fact, Republicans on the national level using Texas to do their bidding. As University of Texas at Austin professor Daniel Bonavac sneers in a federal court filing along with fellow professor John Hatfield, quote, pregnancy is not a disease and elective abortions are not health care. Instead, Bonavac writes, because pregnancy is the result of, quote, voluntary and consensual sexual intercourse, students should not be allowed time off to get abortions. If the students disobey and miss class for abortion care, the filing continues, the professors should be allowed to flunk those students. Additionally, Bonavac asserts that he has a right to refuse to employ a teaching assistant who has had an abortion, calling such women, quote, criminals. Yeah, that's the world that we now live in following Texas's seemingly outrageous at the time law that allowed people to sue those who they had learned had had an abortion or helped someone obtain one, followed quickly by no less than the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court upending 50 years of precedent and reproductive freedoms to declare that there is no constitutional right to reproductive care no matter where you may live anymore in these United States. Joining us now is Amanda Marcotte, senior politics writer at Salon.com and author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America, and Truth Itself. Amanda Marcotte, it has been too long, but welcome back to the broadcast and congratulations on that book whose title I cannot say on the radio.
Well, thank you. And my editor suggested that title. That was not my choice.
That's okay. I would embrace it if I were you. You're not the only one who has a book with a similar name that cannot be pronounced on FCC radio. Anyway, before we delve into this case, this new case out of Texas and some others related to it and why any of them are happening at all as you see it, I need to start with your takeaway from today's 9-0 ruling at the Supreme Court, tossing out this Texas-based challenge to the use of the safe and effective medical abortion drug mifepristone, tossed out based on lack of standing by the challengers.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this was an easy pitch for them. Like, I'm a little surprised it was 9-0. I was expecting at least an Alito Thomas like grumpy dissent, but it was very clear that the court wasn't going to go for this for a couple of reasons. One, the original case was the dumbest case I think I've ever seen in my life.
Yes, I agree.
And second, like, it gives the Supreme Court an easy win in an election year to sort of get a lot of coverage in the press that makes it seem like this abortion issue is like settled and we can all move on and, you know, you can get an abortion, stop worrying about it, blah, 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 which isn't true. And it's not settled. And if Trump gets into office, he will try to ban it nationwide.
Yeah. And, you know, that's sort of, you make my point there. It was a really dumb case. And many of us sort of just dismissed it as stupid. But as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, ignore stupid cases in Texas at your own peril. I mean, it made it all the way to the Supreme Court, even though it was turned away. But, you know, most of us thought it would never get there in the first place, which brings us back to this New federal challenge also happening in Texas federal law, Title IX, signed by Richard Nixon in 1972, as you point out, bars publicly funded schools from discriminating on the basis of sex or gender. And as you write at Salon in response to these two professors hoping to penalize their female students, under Title IX, if male students must be granted leave to travel from school for surgery out of state and so forth, so must a female student. But that is now seemingly under challenge by these two right-wing professors as a violation of their First Amendment rights? Really? What's going on here? And I mean, legally, we'll get to what you argue is really going on here in a second, but legally, how are they even making this case?
They're making kind of the same argument that was made in the abortion pill case, right? Which is that any kind of like engagement with, or like if you ask people in a professional capacity to treat women who have had abortions with the same like respect and dignity that you would treat any other person, in your, that comes across you as like a person that you have to deal with as a professional doing mm-hmm. your job,
right,
that it is somehow a violation of your religious freedom not to just you personally to take out your views on that person and basically just use your job to like punish her for having an abortion, you know.
Yeah, you say that in addition to their anger about abortion, the professors also complain about, quote, not being allowed to punish students for, quote, being homosexual or transgender, end quote, argue that they should be able to penalize teaching assistants for, quote, cross-dressing. I mean, so all of these are violations of the professors' right to free speech as they see it, because their religion, they believe, opposes these things and they ought to be able to express that any way they want, even by flunking students or not hiring teaching assistants. Am I actually understanding this correctly? Because it does seem so insane.
It is it's a stupid case and it doesn't make a ton of sense. But yes, like this is how the religious right defines their First Amendment rights. Literally, that a professor's First Amendment right, his right to free speech and freedom of religion and blah, 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 allows him to force a teaching assistant to dress in clothes of the gender that the professor wants them to dress in. So that student, of course, doesn't have First Amendment or religious rights to dress how they please, right?
Right.
And I think what's interesting is the only people who have rights in this kind of formulation are religious conservatives, mm-hmm. and their rights not only cover their body and their choices, but also cover your body and your choices. Their First Amendment right to deny you the right to be gay, to have an abortion, blah, blah. Like, mm-hmm. it's literally as if I was saying, I can hang a sign in my window. Like, I bet Martha Ann Alito wishes she had a First Amendment right to take somebody else's pride flag down.
There you go. Yeah, that's sort of the equivalent here. Would this suit, speaking of Alito, would this suit have even been brought had Roe v. Wade not been overturned by the corrupt Dobbs decision, as you see it, allowing Texas to ban abortions and residents to punish those who now go out of state to obtain the medical procedure? I mean, it seems to not only be a piece of a piece with that, but sort of the next logical step from those rulings.
It is. They do explicitly say in the lawsuit that it's because of the Dobbs decision. They say that in part for a couple of reasons, like the Biden administration clarified Title IX gives students a right to travel mm-hmm. because, like, you didn't necessarily have to clarify that before because no one really had to before.
Right. But the right to travel out of state to get a medical procedure that they used to be able to get in state.
Exactly. Like, they really kind of only covered rare stuff in the past. Like, if, you know, there was only one doctor in the country or two doctors in the country who could do whatever procedure you needed. Now, of course, you have to travel because it's banned.
Right.
And it's ridiculous, but that's part of the reason. But then they also say explicitly in the lawsuit that because it's a crime in Texas, they don't want to be privy to, they don't want to be complicit in committing crimes. But it's not a crime. It is not a, I want to be very clear. It is not a crime to travel out of state to get an abortion.
Right. Right. So when I then, Amanda Marcotte, got to this part of your piece, well, frankly, I could have seen it coming from 486 miles away. But you note that, quote, even though Bonnevac and Hatfield work in Austin, Texas, they filed their lawsuit 486 miles away in Amarillo, Texas. Now, why would they do that, Amanda?
They want Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, who is also the same judge who originally wrote the opinion saying that a bunch of doctors could ban other doctors from prescribing abortion pills.
Yep.
So he's a crazy crank. He's written all these like papers, like denouncing, basically saying that all sexual expression besides in marriage with the possibility of procreation, so like no contraception, even in marriage, like is wrong, sinful, and that the law should, you know, get involved in preventing that.
You know, we call him a crazy crank. We call these lawsuits dumb, but they go all the way to the Supreme Court. And like I said, you know, kind of feels like we dodged a bullet for now on the Mifepristone case. I suspect it will be back in other forms, in other challenges. But dismissing these cranks at this point seems like a mistake. You cite in your piece on this that Melissa Gira Grant at the New Republic wrote recently that sexual abusers have noticed how these new abortion laws work and that they are taking advantage of them as, quote, an instrument of abuse. How so?
There's been at least three cases in Texas so far of ex-husbands or ex-boyfriends using the Texas abortion ban to file lawsuits to punish their exes for leaving them, for getting an abortion, which was always in conjunction with the like ending of the relationship, which is when you read the materials on these lawsuits, it's clear that the real objection is that these women ended an abusive relationship. And interestingly, the lawyer on all of these cases is Jonathan Mitchell, who is the same guy who wrote the Texas abortion ban. So he is explicitly working with clients whose motive is that they do not accept that a woman left them, and they are going to use the law to harass and torture her to punish her for ending the relationship. And it's really ugly. I recommend people check out some of the details. Like the most prominent case, this ex-husband, like he actually found the abortion pills in his wife's purse and he put them back because he wanted her to have the abortion. And when she did, he was like, I'm calling the police unless you stay with me.
And that's, I think that's the Marcus Silva case, where it's Texas, former Texas Solicitor General Jonathan Mitchell is representing him and some of the other abusers and does seem to be involved. I mean, these two professors in Austin, they didn't dream up this particular lawsuit by themselves. It's part of this right-wing lawfare industry, this far-right lawsuit mill that actually seeks out people like Bonnevac and Hatfield as plaintiffs to challenge laws to further the far-right agenda in these cases that few people other than, you know, folks like you notice at first because they seem so ridiculous when they're filed. But then sure enough, like the Kaczmarek's Mifepristone case, they find their way to the Supreme Court and, you know, can become the law of the land. So Jonathan Mitchell, he's not only, you know, coincidentally representing these folks, as I understand it, he's also part of that America First legal outfit that's being fronted by the former far-right, anti-immigrant, anti-everything Trump advisor Stephen Miller. And much of what they're doing right now is largely setting the table for actual Trump administration policies when and if Trump is allowed back in the White House to be carried out by the DOJ and other federal agencies. Is it fair to say that these sort of seemingly ridiculous cases and legal arguments coming out of places like Texas represent what we should regard as the actual fascistic far-right government policies that we can expect if Trump is ever allowed back in control of the nation's legal system and its federal agencies?
Yes, and I want to flag something about Jonathan Mitchell you overlooked. He's also the lawyer who argued the Trump should be immune from prosecution case in front of the Supreme Court.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, he is. Okay. Yes, he is. So he is the worst in every possible way. And yeah, I mean, so a lot of these groups like Project 2025 and all these other groups, they're pretty explicit. They want a national ban on abortion. They want a national ban on abortion through Congress, but if they can't get it through Congress, they have a plan to use the executive branch's powers to unilaterally ban it through Trump.
And how seriously should we take concerns that we've heard from Republicans, and this sort of also came out of the Dobbs case overturning Roe, that we ought to take a look at whether Americans actually have a right to contraception, whether that should be banned or, you know, should allow states to ban that as well. That also seemed ridiculous. Should we take that as not quite as ridiculous as it seems right now?
If they didn't plan on banning contraception, they would have voted for the Democratic bill that said, we will not ban contraception. The Democrats teed that up for Republicans. They were like, here's a bill that says we will not ban contraception. It is illegal now to ban contraception. An easy vote if this is how you feel. And yet all but two Republicans voted against it in the Senate. So, I mean, of course they are. Like, the religious right has been setting up the arguments for banning contraception for the entirety of my career as a reporter on this issue, which is like almost 20 years at this point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and by the way, and then that vote in the Senate you mentioned, I think, was just this past week. Do you remember who the two Republicans were who actually voted, who are they?
Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski.
Oh, is that right? That's easy to remember, isn't it? So they were the only two Republicans who voted to keep contraception available across the nation. Unbelievable. So, which kind of underscores my last question to you here, Amanda. All of these things that they are trying to do, that the right is trying to do, these are not popular among the electorate. The electorate likes contraception. and so, you know, when and if they actually hear about these things, they're not happy. It begs the question, what is really going on here in these cases, Amanda? And you write a little bit about it in the piece on these two professors. What are these types of cases and ultimately these policies really about as you see it?
Well, and that's why it was so important that you made that point about how Jonathan Mitchell isn't just an anti-abortion fanatic, that he is a part of a larger project to sort of rewrite the presidency as this authoritarian, autocratic dictatorship, basically. And I think it's really important for people to understand that there's a lot of talk now that often gets very abstract about authoritarianism, rising fascism, and the end of democracy. And I think, you know, that's all very scary, but I don't know that it's necessarily obvious to people like why they're just, it's not obvious. We all know why Donald Trump wants to end democracy, because he wants to be president until he dies. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's not, I think, entirely clear to people why he's got so much support in this project. And it's for reasons like that. They want to ban abortion nationwide. they know that that is never going to pass in a democratic society. Mm-hmm. And right now, even when they try to ban on a state level, voters keep overturning it, you know? So the answer is don't let the voters have a say. Like, don't let voters exist. Mm-hmm. Like,
well, I think on another level, I'm trying to get at why you think, I mean, it would be one thing if they actually had a, as the court says, a sincerely held religious belief against these things. But you actually argue that this is more about control of women than it is about any sort of actual religious belief.
Yeah, I mean, it is in so far as there. Well, we know this because of things like the Marcus Silva case. Right. Like, he didn't have a problem with his wife getting an abortion. He had a problem with his wife leaving him.
Right.
And the fact that Jonathan Mitchell is willing to stand by such a guy, I think, tells you the whole story. But also, like, it's really obvious when you look at who their leader is. It's Donald Trump, mm-hmm. a guy who just got convicted 34 times on a case involving him paying hush money to a porn star. Like, this is not about deep faith, about sexual morality and life, or much less life. Like, in a lot of these cases that we're looking at under these abortion bans, women's pregnancies are already failing and they're still being denied care. Like, they don't care. They just want them to suffer. You know, mm-hmm. and it really is just a very sadistic, misogynistic worldview that is like a lot. And, you know, even if like individual conservatives don't like are uncomfortable with, say, making the woman having a miscarriage bleed out in a emergency room parking lot, they will allow it because they stand by the sort of larger principle that these laws uphold, which is that women are not people with rights worth respecting. Mm.
That does seem to be what it comes down to, doesn't it? Amanda Marcotte, senior politics writer at Salon.com. I will, of course, link to your article on the Texas professors who are suing to fail students who seek abortions. She is also the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters, set on rat effing liberals, America, and truth itself. And by the way, the other person with a book with a similar name is our old friend and editor at Salon, David Daly, and his book, which also has that word in the title. Anyway, we will link to that as well. You can find Amanda on the site still known as Twitter at Amanda Marcotte. And you can, over at Salon.com, of course, her work is there. And you can also subscribe to her biweekly standing room only political newsletter. Great speaking with you, Amanda. Really appreciate it. And hope to do so soon in the future.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you. Okay. Well, we'll take a quick break. We've almost made it through, Des.
I know. Good job.
Boy, I've had it with this COVID crap.
Yep, I bet.
Enough with the COVID crap. Stop infecting me, Desi Doyen. That said, we got a special gift for you coming up in the next block.
Oh,
don't
yes.
we? Well, you'll wait to see what it is. That's straight ahead on the broadcast in our latest Green News Report. Don't go away. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Okay, so what is that special gift we have in your latest Green News Report?
An unusual, very rare, Brad-free Green
yeah,
News
there
Report.
You go. See, that's a gift for everyone. No Brad in today's Green News Report. I figured I was not feeling well, would save my voice, would leave it all up to Desiree. We'll see how she does in our latest Green News Report.
It's not just the temperature that matters, but also the combination of temperature and humidity.
In parts of the U.S., some cooling systems can no longer keep up with extreme heat waves.
We had a very rare event, the kind of event we only see once every 500 to once every 1,000 years.
Wow. Record rain triggers flash flooding from Sarasota to Spain to China. Plus, renewable energy in the U.S. has delivered $250 billion in health benefits, study finds. All of those findings and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Desi Doyen. Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and because Brad Friedman tested positive for COVID again, not nearly enough snarky comment. This is your Green News Report. Okay, before we get started, a heads up. An extreme heat wave is forecast to broil the central and eastern U.S. in coming days, potentially producing dangerously high temperatures and high humidity that could last for days or weeks. Serious heat waves are hitting earlier than usual across the U.S. this year, which can bring higher risk because people haven't yet had time to adjust to the higher temperatures. So stay safe out there. Speaking of heat, The Guardian reports that in parts of the U.S., air conditioning systems are increasingly unable to keep up with record-breaking temperatures and high humidity, particularly older residential cooling systems that were not designed for our climate-intensified heat waves. And it matters because extreme heat is the number one weather-related cause of death in the United States. Last year, extreme heat killed at least 2,300 Americans. In an interview with AP, climate scientist Andrew Dessler warned,
"You know, this is the new normal. It's not just about this summer. It's about every summer for the rest of your lives is going to be hot. This is a small preview of the future. And in 10 or 20 years, people are going to look back on this and they're going to say, I can't believe how cool it was. I wish it were that cool again. Because the warming from climate change is just inexorable. It's just, we're going to, as long as we're dumping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's going to keep getting warmer. And so it's just going to be this on steroids in the future."
Oh, fun. South Florida careened from record heat to record rainfall this week, with some areas seeing 10 inches of rain in a single day on Wednesday, triggering flash floods that paralyzed downtown Sarasota, which saw a record-breaking deluge of 4 inches in a single hour, a one-in-a-thousand-year event. Climate scientists say man-made global warming is increasing the frequency and intensity of such deluges because a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. Good thing Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis recently deleted all mention of climate change in state law. Multiple rain bombs also triggered flash floods in parts of China, Chile, and Spain, all on the same day. The costs of flood damage are rising in the U.S. Flooding is increasing in severity due to extreme storms and rising sea levels, and it now costs the U.S. economy roughly $200 billion to $500 billion every year in damages and economic disruption, according to a new report from Democrats on the Senate Joint Economic Committee. That's equivalent to more than 1% of the nation's gross domestic product last year. The report says massive investment is needed to update the nation's flood control infrastructure to protect the U.S. economy. But as costs of climate impacts rise, so do the benefits of climate action. A new analysis published this week calculates that the rise of renewable energy in the U.S. is paying off in both cutting emissions and measurably improving air quality. The scientists calculated that since just 2019, renewables have yielded roughly $250 billion in climate and public health benefits. Because wind and solar energy are displacing fossil-fueled power plants for electricity, in turn reducing the public's exposure to toxic air pollutants from fossil fuel combustion that cause respiratory diseases, asthma, and cancers. And finally, more states are moving to hold big oil accountable for climate damages. The New York legislature this week followed Vermont's lead, passing a polluters pay law. Modeled after the federal Superfund Superfund law, New York's Climate Change Superfund Act requires fossil fuel companies to compensate the state for the destruction caused by climate change, primarily driven by the burning of their product. If signed by Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul, the law would charge fossil fuel companies for their share of historical emissions contributing to climate change, raising an estimated $3 billion annually. Well, that would be nice. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and the site still known as Twitter, at Green News Report. Brad will be back soon. From bradblog.com, I'm Desi Joyen, and this has been your Green News Report.
I'm back.
Uh-huh. Very well done, Desi Doyen.
I tried, but I missed you.
No, you didn't. I'm
yes,
going to get
I
all
did.
Kinds of notes. Feel free to drop me an email at bradcast@bradblog.com saying, yeah, Brad, what are you doing holding her back? She's great without you on the Green News Report. Who needs you?
We need that snarky comment.
Well, we'll see.
I do want to follow up on that South Florida record rain that they've been having. They got 20 inches of rain over just 2 days in parts of South Florida.
20 inches of rain.
Yeah.
In 2 days in Florida.
And now the good news is that that has helped South Florida get out of a persistent drought. They had a really major rain deficit, but, you know, this was at a very high cost, and the impact does not bode well for hurricane season, which is forecast to be, you know, potentially a really, really, really bad one for the East Coast of the United States, and specifically Florida.
Was it in Florida where we saw someone refer to what was going on down there as car soup?
Yes.
At this point in the street?
Yes. Whenever you see the cars floating around, this guy calls it car soup. So Florida is in store for more car soup.
Okay. I could use some soup now that I think about it.
True.
Some chickens leave out the cars. So let's get the hell out of here. Thank you again, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to our guest today, Salon's Amanda Marcotte. And our thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us and tolerating my voice. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves or help me buy some more nasal spray. That's bradblog.com/donate. Thank you very much in advance. Drop me email. As noted, I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, you will find me at TheBradBlog, and you will find Desi Doyen at
Green News Report. Please come by and say hi.
Follow both of us if you don't mind, and repost when possible. It helps now that Elon Musk has essentially squelched both of our accounts over there. So liking and retweeting really helps. Thanks for that as well. All right, that's it. Anything else?
I think that's it. We just need you to get well.
Okay, working on it. Until we meet again, I am Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.